how to do this via Zoom. And if you have recommendations on how to do it better, I'd love to hear it. But for now, what we're going to do is, if you have questions while the speaker, Brad Wind, is talking, go ahead and put it in the chat box. And I'll look at it and interrupt him if it's pertinent to what he's talking about, or we can save it until the end. But the point of this class is for that kind of interaction back and forth. And so I strongly encourage that if you have those questions to show them in the chat box, or say you have a question and we can turn it over to you to ask the question of Brad. It's important, I think, to us and the students especially. I'd really like to see some questions from the students as you guys listen to all of our speakers. So with that, last week we talked about state water institutions. We talked about the policy agency, Colorado Water Conservation Board. But most of the water that is run in Colorado is run by more local and regional institutions. And today we have with us Brad Wind. And Brad is the executive director of the Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District. This district has been around for over almost 100 years and is responsible for putting water in eastern Colorado. Brad is an engineer by training, ag and civil engineer by training, but he does have a master's in business also from CSU. Is that right, Brad?
That's correct.
Right. All right. So I've asked Brad to talk a little bit about Northern and about about what Northern does and how it interacts with folks and some of the interesting issues that are going on. So with that, Brad, I'm going to turn it over to you, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer. Everyone can hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Well, it's a privilege to be here. Wish we were in person, but life goes on nonetheless. One thing I mentioned to folks that are maybe a little bit new to the water world, in some ways I view perspectives on water, oddly enough, somewhat like religion. We all view it a little bit differently. Some don't view it at all, which is perfectly fine, but often it has bias in our upbringing, our experiences through college, our experiences through our careers, and that applies to me as well. So I just mentioned that as you hear me talk, you'll hear tones of my background. In particular, I was raised in eastern Colorado on an irrigated farm, so from time to time I might have a little bit of perspective that has bias, and that's okay. On how I think about water and our future in Colorado with the limited resources that we have. But that's good, because the next person that comes along has their perspective, and somewhere in the middle of all of that is probably the truth or the direction which we're headed in the state. So with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about Northern Water, how it relates to what I'll term as a CBT project, Colorado Big Thompson Project, which is one of our core missions here at Northern Water. We don't get too far away from that core mission in operating with the Bureau of Reclamation, the Colorado Big Thompson Project, which is a very complex federally owned, primarily, not exclusively, but primarily federally owned project here in northeastern Colorado. Talk a little bit about another project that Northern Water took on somewhat independently, or certainly more independently, called the Windy Gap Project. Then talk about briefly a couple projects that we've got that we're advancing in Northern Colorado, anticipation for all the demand that's coming online. As you all know, we're growing in a population. Could I ask of the students, Coloradoans, born and raised, new to the state, what's maybe new to the state, or four new to the state? Okay, well, you know as well as anybody, we're growing. So Northern Water, along with a lot of other agencies, trying to prepare for that growth in the water supplies. And then lastly, and maybe more importantly, is just challenges that I see coming down the pike, some of them already here, and opportunities associated with those challenges. So I'm going to do my best to share my screen. All right. Everyone seen that okay?
Looks good.
All right. Thanks, Jennifer. We got a lot of ground to cover, and we want to be done in 40-ish minutes, 35-ish minutes?
That's right, about 40 minutes, and save time for questions afterwards.
Okay. Well, good enough. Well, nothing like getting us acquainted with our region of the state and how it's influenced by Northern Water than looking at a map. So in front of you, I'll keep time and time again referencing Northern Water, and some people call it, you know, Northern Water District, and what that district represents is the area in green. So it's a geographical area that spans from roughly the city and county of Broomfield to the south, up north toward Wyoming, up to just north of Wellington area, and then eastward along the Poudre, along the Big Thompson, along the St. Vrain, along Boulder Creek, east to the South Platte River and lands in which it historically irrigated. And then as you get to Greeley, our district boundaries primarily follow the historical irrigated lands and still to this day, mostly irrigated lands along the South Platte River. So when I reference the district, that's those lands and those people within that district in which I'm referencing. As it relates to the CBT project, again, that's a water diversion project. Extracts exports from the Colorado River Basin in Grand County, primarily. A lot of folks don't realize there is about 8,000 to 10,000 acre feet per year that actually comes from the East Slope, but nonetheless, the bulk of it comes out of Grand County. And that's the CBT project, again, owned largely by the federal government. As I mentioned, we have, I didn't mention this, 1.6 million acres within that greenish area in our district. That constitutes about 630,000 irrigated acres. And just last year, we passed the million person mark in northeastern Colorado, which is kind of reflects that, you know, roughly 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 Coloradoans gets their water in part, some in a very small way, others in a very big way, water from Northern Water, be it the Colorado Big Thompson Project, or as I'll describe, the Windy Gap Project, which that compares to, you know, Denver Water. I think they suggest that I think it's 1 in 3 Coloradoans gets water from Denver Water, again, all associated with the density of the population within their service area. The project was constructed at the direction of Reclamation, Bureau of Reclamation, from 1938 to 1957. First deliveries came out of Horse Tooth Reservoir right in your backyard in 1958, and really designed for ag, municipal, industrial, and domestic supplies, and provides about 215,000 acre feet per year. That's an average number. It's up some years, down others. I'll describe why that is. To put that in context, that's about a quarter of the supply, the South Platte supply, within our district. So it's a sizable amount of water to contribute as a supplemental supply to the South Platte Basin. So absent the CBT project, the river, the South Platte River and its tributaries would be running roughly 75% of what they run in an average year at the present time. More about kind of the people and providing that municipal use of water. Don't look at the details here. It really just highlights all the many water purveyors. They go by a lot of different names. Special districts, the larger land masses are what are called special districts. There was once a time when they were called rural domestics, but they were really created under the Special District Act of Colorado. And they were mostly servicing lands that, albeit many of them are still rural areas, some of those special districts take on some smaller towns and quite an amount of population within our district. And those are the bigger blocks, and then you probably recognize some of the smaller ones are various cities, towns along the way that we provide water to, again, either directly. Well, for these providers, I think I can say safely we provide water, not all their water, because Northern Water, by its definition, is a provider of supplemental supplies. But we can physically provide untreated water to the filter plants and the treatment plants of all these various water purveyor or kind of end utilities agencies to deliver water then to their underlying customers. One of them, of course, is Fort Collins. Interestingly enough, portions of Fort Collins, I think about a quarter of Fort Collins, is actually provided not by the city of Fort Collins, but by the Fort Collins-Loveland Water District, which is another one of these special districts. Back to the CBT project, it's a fairly complex project, probably to some one of a few of the most complex projects in the West. Reclamation built these projects in the 17 Western states from 1905. Jennifer, you might know the earlier projects up until there's some projects in the 80s. And at that time, Reclamation kind of changed their mission. A lot of the water had been developed in the West, and they're on to more operational maintenance activities associated with their various projects, which they're partners in. So for the CBT project, as you can see some statistics on the slide, one thing that as folks understand more about the operations of the CBT project, they often think about it in terms of the water it provides, but in fact it's has 7 hydroelectric plants. Those plants provide power, which is marketed through WAPA, the Western Administrative Power Authority, and distributed throughout, for the CBT project, Colorado and 3, sometimes 4 nearby states. So just a little bit of the operations of the project. Again, I'm still speaking about the CBT project. There's 2 maps in front of you. On the left is where the water is collected. And Northern Water has about 25 staff that are headquartered, come to work every day at the FAR pumping plant, which is kind of our headquarters on the West Slope. And the West Slope operations essentially are capturing water, working with Reclamation to do this, but capturing snowmelt primarily that comes off the western portions of Rocky Mountain National Park. And that water flows into Grand Lake, Shadow Mountain Reservoir, which is toward the top of your left map, and also some into Lake Granby, which is really the main storage vessel of the project. So as that water's coming off in June and into July, primarily, also into Willow Creek off to the left, it's another sizable watershed within the system. It really gets housed or captured within that kind of that biggest bucket in the project. And from that point on, one of the primary tasks of Northern Water and Bureau of Reclamation is to reposition that water out of Lake Granby, which takes a lift of water, roughly 100 feet, to pump it up to Shadow Mountain. It then travels into Grand Lake, and then clear at the top of your screen, you'll see the west portal of the Adams Tunnel. And water travels through that tunnel at a maximum capacity of 550 cubic feet per second. And then that transitions, that tunnel goes under Rocky Mountain National Park, under the Continental Divide or through the Continental Divide, and it brings that Colorado River water, water that otherwise would go off to the Pacific, and it brings it over to the east side of the Continental Divide, and it augments or supplements supplies, along with some other supplies from the other side of the mountains, but primarily supplements South Platte supplies and the various tributaries. So that water pops out just above Estes Park from the tunnel. It goes through a series of penstocks, power plants as it comes down in elevation to ultimately come to locations just west of Berthoud, which is where I am right now. That's our headquarters for Northern Water. We have about 125 staff. They're headquartered in Berthoud. And about 5 miles west of Berthoud, that water departs the Flatiron Power Plant, one of the last primary power plants of the project, and it gets bifurcated, it gets split, and some of that water goes into Carter Lake Reservoir, which takes pumping to do that. You have to lift it into Carter Lake, and the balance of it primarily heads north. Some of it drops down into the Big Thompson River to meet irrigation demands and demands from City of Loveland, for example, but then most of it travels north in a canal along the foothills and gets delivered to Horsetooth Reservoir, where it's repositioned, stored. Horsetooth gets filled up through the course of the winter months, and it's positioned there and ready for use by either municipalities, who often are what I would call hardwired into the project. They have treatment plants, for example, at Soldier Canyon Dam on Horsetooth. There's a plant there for the tri-districts, three large special water districts that treat water and take those waters east and south, as well as the City of Port Collins treats its water there as well. And then that water getting delivered to the river, primarily for irrigation, gets kicked out of the north end of Horsetooth Reservoir down the Hanson Supply Canal and gets delivered right into the Poudre River, where then those downstream irrigators who order that water, they work very closely with state administrators of the river and get it, coordinate the rediversion of that water, the diversion of that water that we provide to the river, and then they take it into the canals along with their native supplies, their supplies that they have water rights to along, the, in that case, along the Poudre River. One of the unique, and I think this is unique to all other reclamation projects that have been created in the West, is that it's by definition CBT supplies are supplemental. It was recognized early on, you know, before a lot more people showed up in our district, just thinking about the irrigation demand, that it took a pretty strong hydrologic year, a pretty wet year for the irrigation lands within the South Platte and its tributaries to be kind of fully satisfied, able to grow a crop, particularly sugar beets, which often take irrigation water to late in the year. But we seldom have, you can't bank on a wet year versus a dry one. So that shortcoming was really what the impetus was to think about ways in which to bring water from the West Slope and invest in a project with the federal government to do just that. Thinking about the supplemental nature of the CBT drives the board to do one of the most important tasks they have, Jennifer and her peers on the Northern Water Board, to make a critical election in terms of how much water the CBT project and Northern Water are going to allocate in a given year. And it's quite contrary to how most irrigation companies and even those who supply municipal and industrial supplies allocate water. Typically, if there's more water, you allocate more. That's by and large how it's done in the West. With the CBT project, it's quite the contrary. When there's a good native supply and needs can primarily be met with native supplies, then the board issues a lower quota. And the quota is nothing more than, if the quota is a 50% quota, which typically aligns with a wet year, then those who own what are called CBT units or allotment contracts that define how many units different parties have, about 1,300 individual agencies and people have interest in the project, contractual interest in the project. And if the quota is issued at 50%, for each acre foot unit in which they own, they get 0.5 acre feet. The other side of the spectrum is that in very dry years, historically, could change in the future, but at least historically, the board is prompted to issue more water, and the quota could be, for example, 100%. So in that year, those owners of CBT units would get 1 acre foot of wet water delivered from the project for every acre foot unit in which they own. As I mentioned, there's about 1,300 of these various contract holders. Some of them are Mr. and Mrs. Farmer that might have 50 units, and others are the city of Boulder that might have 22,000 units or something along those lines. So it varies by lotee how many units they actually own. Let's see, I touched on this.
Brad, can you go back to that slide?
You bet.
You want to talk about the nature of these units and who owns them and how's that changed over the century?
Yeah, I got a slide coming up here, Jennifer. Okay. I think I'll touch exactly on it. Thank you. I'm going to have to keep moving on here. Let's. this is what Jennifer was getting at. The ownership of the project initially was largely ag. 95% of the project, so to speak, was owned and delivered to agricultural use. At the present time, as this slide shows, the ag ownership is 30%, so a significant shrink in ag ownership, and municipal and industrial ownership is now 70%. These units are bought and sold and traded on the kind of open free market. It does require approval of Northern Water's Board of Directors, but it's quite unique, and that water can be bought and sold from anybody within our district and to anybody in our district, assuming that they have a demonstrated need for the water for ag, municipal, or industrial uses. However, we're pretty proud of the fact that, again, back to some flexibility that some other projects don't offer, just because one owns that water and holds it in their portfolio, in many years they may not need that water because of maybe demand hasn't come online, maybe their native supplies, other portions of their portfolio might be rich in a given year, and they can actually lease that water to other water users within our district. So the bottom two numbers kind of reflect the fact that even though the ownership might be 30-70, ag still has the majority of use on the project. So 1 year a farmer could sell his water, but the next year he could perhaps lease it back. Now, a lease is a year-to-year arrangement versus ownership would be something they could rely on for many years to come. So Jennifer, I think this is the trend that kind of explains what I just mentioned a little bit more efficiently. And these, as I mentioned, on the left are the number of units. There's 310,000 units in the project. Think of them as shares, say, in a corporation. We just happen to call them units. And back in 57 and 58, when we were trying to get this project online, the green line shows the ownership that's in ag. And the lower one, the blue, and municipal and industrial users. And as time's gone on, as development has occurred, as cities and towns have grown, it's been a very nice supply to go to provide taps we all rely on in our homes. You might notice in the late 1960s, there's quite a bit of activity that went on there. That was reflective of the special districts came online, or several of them within our area. So those were kind of a recognized need that portions of rural Colorado within our district boundaries needed a clean and higher quality water supply. So those districts were developed. They created distribution networks in which to get treated water into the rural areas. And to supply that demand, they largely looked to acquiring CBT to treat and to distribute. Now let me make one more comment on the line. What's interesting to economists in particular is the end is near. Not to scare anyone, but at some point there is not a lot more water to be transferred. So the CBT project in so many ways has provided that supply for the population to grow within much of northeastern Colorado, but it can't go on forever because at some point there's not any more to transfer from ag. There'll always be some in ag for good reason, in my opinion. Some of the kind of the contractual requirements that will keep some water in ag is that there are some, for example, open lands, land that have conservation easements on them, in which that CBT unit is bundled within that conservation easement and required to stay on that land in perpetuity. A lot of that goes on in Boulder County. So in my view, that water will always be tied up in ag. But what's driving all this, and at least on my computer screen, Jennifer, I can't see the right-hand side. I know what's there, but it's probably, and I could just describe if it's the same challenge behind other people, because I've just seen people on the right-hand side. Anyway, this graphic just demonstrates that over the last few years, the price of CBT unit to encourage a seller to sell to a buyer, which is often the municipality or someone in the housing development industry, are willing to pay significant money. This shows up to $50,000. In fact, it's a little dated. That's up to 2019. 2020, there were prices pre-COVID up into the $60,000 per acre foot unit. So if you convert that into kind of wet water, our average quota that the board sets is roughly 0.7, 0.72. So for a wet acre foot unit, or excuse me, a wet acre foot of water, you're upwards of $80,000. And you hear and read stories, articles in the paper about the challenges that home builders have in providing a tap that might cost $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 on top of building a home. And at some point, it becomes a little challenging for folks to acquire a new home in the Front Range of Colorado. So very briefly, albeit very important to Northern Water, but let me do a time check here. We got to move on. I mentioned the Windy Gap Project. The Conservancy Act has the ability for conservancy districts to create a sub-district. That sub-district can pursue its own projects, and Northern Water Board took advantage of that in the 70s and early 80s, and kind of independent of the federal government, albeit we use federal facilities, Northern Water sub-district, with the help of several larger municipalities along the Front Range, filed for water right on the Colorado River, another water right, west of the town of Granby, and built the Windy Gap Project. And that brings over 20 to 30,000 acre feet of water per year. It is a pumping plant on the Colorado River, a small on-channel reservoir, which is going away, by the way. One of the a project called the Colorado River Connectivity Channel, in which that small low head dam is going to be partially removed to allow connectivity between the upper and lower Colorado River in that vicinity west of Granby as mitigation for a project that Windy Gap's building. But nonetheless, the pumping plant sits there. When it's in priority, it pumps water up into Lake Granby, and water, that Windy Gap water, which is accounted for separately, is temporarily stored in Lake Granby and then ultimately carried through the project physically in the same fashion that the CBT supplies are. But again, it's a new water right. It's a junior water right. And I wanted to just mention this because one of the projects that you might be hearing about in the paper that's advancing, and a project that has all of its permits at the present time but is tied up in some litigation based on the record of decision, is the Windy Gap Firming Project, which is a reservoir associated with water coming from the Windy Gap Project. And I'll visit about that here shortly.
Brad, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Please.
Going back to CBT and the marketing issue, a question has arisen about, you talked about pre-COVID marketing. How has COVID affected the marketing of these units?
Well, that's a good question. I think there was a lot of, I don't know the building community, home building community real well, but my presumption has been that there's some trepidation in how we're all going to work, unemployment perhaps challenges or employment challenges in, say, within Northern Colorado. And I think all those uncertainties kind of started folks to start pulling back on their home building commitments. Now I think it's kind of, we're kind of over that. But we haven't necessarily seen as much activity in the marketplace as we would say of, in January, February, as compared to the months post-March. Now, just when you look around and you see all the new home starts, I think at some point the activity's got to pick back up. But we just saw a little bit of softening in the marketplace. I mean, again, Northern Waters Board, NORD staff dictate those transactions and the amount in which people are paying for the transfer of those units, but it's been slow. And I think just everyone's just kind of uneasy, not knowing what our future economy is going to look like.
Thanks.
So I'd mentioned there's two challenges with Windy Gap as it was, I won't say originally designed. There was always a recognition that Windy Gap's a fairly junior water right on the Colorado River. So when you're junior, you're kind of later in the queue, maybe last in the queue of water rights, and you're not always guaranteed you'll get a supply. And if it's a drier year, your water right might not come into priority. So it yields nothing. Windy Gap, from day one, and it was known, it suffers from two challenges. One, it's a junior water right. So if you have a dry year in the Colorado River, it doesn't come into priority. And two, at times when it does come into priority, as I mentioned, I'm stepping back a slide, Windy Gap Reservoir on the Colorado River is a very small reservoir. It's really more of a mechanism to impound water for a number of hours while the Windy Gap pump plant pulls that water out of the river and kicks it into Lake Granby. What sometimes happens in years in which it isn't priority, Lake Granby is full. So it's completely full, and at that point, it's futile to put more supplies into Lake Granby because it just spills out. So Windy Gap Water Right and the participants of the Windy Gap Project have always struggled with realizing in a dry year there's no water, and then sometimes over a series of wet years when Lake Granby's full with CBT water, it also yields no water. So to remedy that, participants in Windy Gap are promoting and have all the permits in place to build what's called Chimney Hollow Reservoir to firm up that supply so that you take a situation where you have sporadic supplies from a Windy Gap plant and you are able to park it into a new reservoir and make that water available to its participants over a series of years and don't have to worry about what you do in those years when the project yielded nothing. So that project is well on its way. As I mentioned, it has all of its federal, local, state permits, and we're kind of locking horns. I shouldn't say we. There was a claim by a handful of conservation environmental groups questioning the adequacy of the record of decision, and at some point there'll be a federal judge that will make an opinion on that. Chimney Hollow is going to be right in the backyard from where I sit here in Berthoud. It'll be right west of Carter Lake Reservoir, 90,000 acre feet. And I'll tied in. There's a graphic on the right hand side of your screen that shows it being physically tied into the CBT project, which allows it then to deliver cap. Bring water into itself from the CBT project and then deliver water back out to participants through the same CBT project. And this project will, we have arrangements in place with Larimer County in which Larimer County will provide the recreational amenities to Larimer County and others around the state for what I would call pretty passive recreational opportunities. And there is a rendition of Chimney Hollow Reservoir. Again, we would like to think we're not too many months away from starting construction on this. We have a construction contract with a contractor out of Montana to build this. It's a fairly unique dam. United States, there's only one other very small, and this will be quite large. This will be the second highest dam in the state of Colorado, but it's going to be an asphalt core dam, which is quite popular in Europe, but there's only one other one in the United States. So on to Something that draws a little bit more fire, at least in the Fort Collins area, is Northern Water's proposal to build a Northern Integrated Supply Project, which is right in Fort Collins. Portions of it are in the backyard of Fort Collins, and it relies on some of its supply from the Poudre River. And one might ask, well, you know, why NISP? It's kind of in so many ways an extension of, you know, why the CBT project, why Windy Gap, why NISP, is recognizing that as we grow, we need additional water supplies. That's not to suggest that we shouldn't be conserving water. As time goes on, and Jennifer can attest to this, our board thinks and talks more about what's the nexus between land use planning and water use. And it's there. We all know it's there. It's challenging to kind of get your arms around how to influence that, at least from a conservancy district standpoint. So we need to be doing all those things, but at least Northern Water would argue, along with some other water providers, that we need to at least identify unappropriate supplies and advance projects that are mindful to the environment, mitigate impacts, but yet get them put in place. And in our opinion, there's supplies on the Poudre River and the South Platte in which to drive another project. I'm not saying there's dozens of them left to build like this, but we think there's good reasons to build infrastructure that I'll talk about related to NISP. And of course, there's some local water providers that are building large projects within the Poudre as well.
So Brad, we have a question from one of our students. Johanna, do you want to go ahead and ask your question?
Sure. So I was just wondering, because you were talking about, you know, the end is near in terms of kind of the shares and allotment and agriculture kind of not having a lot of shares, and therefore it becoming like really expensive to get an extra share, and how it kind of impacts the housing developers. And I was wondering how much of that also could go into kind of regulations in terms of what towns do in terms of how they use the water. For example, like a lot of neighborhoods in Fort Collins require green lawns. If there's going to be kind of a change in regulation towards that to allow for more kind of development in that sense. I don't know if that's clear.
Well, I think what you're getting at, and I'm sorry I suggested the end is near, that sounds very bleak. So it's only in terms of kind of the accessibility to you know, significant amounts of CBT units. But I think what you're getting at is kind of this whole land use nexus. And our board historically has really shied away from that discussion. I think there's an appetite for, there's some limited, Jennifer's the attorney that I would look toward, but I believe there's some limited tools that a conservancy district could have in which to influence how water gets used from its project. It's a little bit of a slippery slope. We want to encourage the right things, but yet, for example, the participants in our project, which pay the freight, they pay for the development of this water supplies, kind of how much should we step on the visions that they might have for their city and for their industries that they're desiring to attract? I think there's
Brad, I think with this, and we saw it with the 1041 permit proposal, and that is, how much are these municipal providers conserving? Are they taking that seriously? And how does Northern help them do that?
And the statistics that we presented to the Board of County Commissioners in the discussion that Jennifer is referencing, participants in these newer projects are kind of finding ways to use less. To your question, we're not to the point where we might suggest you grow less lawns in your community if you want to advance these projects. But I think some people, that's maybe what they're aiming for. one of the realities of more expensive water is, at least my observation is, water purveyors, so those who kind of take water from us, treat it, and get it delivered along with other supplies to in their distribution systems to the homeowner, because of the cost of the water, I think it's driving a smaller footprint, you know, in the front yard. It's just they're offering taps. They call them different things, but you can now buy a half tap, or some call them a conservation tap, where you're committing as a homeowner in perpetuity to pay less for a tap that provides less water to your home. And as such, you're agreeing to grow a smaller lawn or use less outdoor water.
Brad, talk a little bit about the grant program that we have and helping people trying to reduce their water.
Northern Water, and this is not common in, or it is common in other municipalities, both big and small, of trying to put some resources, cash, into developing demonstration projects throughout various communities to demonstrate. You can have a pleasant look and feel that's maybe to some a little more appropriate in the arid west than just irrigating, you know, square foot after square foot of bluegrass. And we have a great, if you ever come to Northern Water, please stop by dawn to dusk and take a look at our conservation gardens, as we call them. And there's many landscapes, xeric landscapes in our backyard that demonstrate some of the things that we would encourage folks to start moving toward. And that takes an investment. But I think for the foreseeable future, Northern Water will be serving up a couple $1 million a year in grants to help keep demonstrating some of those things.
So Brad, I've interrupted you, but this might be a good time for us to just unshare your screen and talk a little bit. I think that it would be also, I'm glad you mentioned the conservation gardens, and I encourage everybody to go look at them. Why don't you tell them about the one special plant that bloomed this summer?
Well, we had an agave plant. It's called Perry's agave plant, I don't know. I'm from Eastern Colorado, so I know a lot about corn and sugar beets, but I don't know a lot about landscape aping plants. But it's a desert southwestern U.S. Plant. I kind of broadly would throw it in the kind of the cactus family, which is probably not appropriate. But if you get on our website, it blooms every 15 to 20 years. Blooms, it grows a stalk that's 20 feet tall, and then it dies. So it is, I predict it's on its last week right now. So if nothing else, come to Northern Water and see a plant that you don't see in that state. But every 15 or 20 years, it's just an amazing plant.
So Brad, talk a little bit about some of the organizations or some of the groups that you're involved with that look more regionally at issues in this area.
You know, one that comes to mind that Northern Water and I think provides a service to its constituents that probably was not envisioned when it was organized in 1937. And Jennifer, I think about the recovery programs. Northern Water has been, I would argue, instrumental in creating, supporting programs that protect, improve habitat for endangered species. We do that on the Upper Colorado River. Support a program that does that for several fish species on the western slope in Colorado. And in more recent years, we have advocated and promoted a fairly complex recovery program. I think it's one viewed by the recovery program world as being one that's extremely successful, and it's between Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, and the federal government in preserving, providing water and cash to buy land to protect whooping cranes and several shorebirds within central Nebraska. And those are, I think, good examples of where we are kind of that. Our former general manager, Eric Wilkinson, I thought had a great term and views northern water as a shock absorber, providing the connection between the federal government, which we know most intimately, Northern Water, as our partners in operating a project. Same time, the federal government can have a very big hammer through the Endangered Species Act. And if you don't get your ducks in a row and come up with a creative way to support the species and advance their cause, bad things can happen to water users. And we tend to, I think, do that very well, make a linkage between a very large federal government and the needs of our local water providers who are maybe tuned out. I mean, their core mission is making sure we all get our irrigation water on the day we order it, that we all get high quality water at our tap when we turn the tap on, and that's their focus, and that is a huge need and an important critical need infrastructure within certainly our district boundaries, but sometimes they don't have the resources, the capabilities, the desire, whatever it might be, to make that linkage between, hey, what's the federal government doing? How can we support, in this case, that need? Sometimes not support it. Sometimes take an opposing view of some things. But that's something conservancy districts, and as you learn more, conservation districts can provide that regional perspective, attempt to get consensus on how to advance something, when to advance, when to push back a little bit. And Northern Water, at least in northeastern Colorado, north of Denver, I think, provides that role.
So to help the class, the Conservancy Act is what gives the authority for Northern to put this together. And there are many different conservancy districts out there. There are 5 conservation districts that are set up specifically by statute. The main difference in, there's a lot of minor differences, but the main difference is if you're in the conservation district, your board is appointed by county commissioners. And if you're in conservancy district, your board is appointed by the water courts or the courts. So, but they essentially do the same thing. They work with the federal government. They work with these different entities.
Also, I think, Jennifer, there's 50, I think it's 51 conservancy districts in the state. Many of them have an affiliation with the federal government in terms of operating a federal project. Most of them are very small, just maybe a pumping plant, maybe a small reservoir in the mountains that was a project initiated by the Bureau of Reclamation. In Colorado, Northern's a little bit unique in being heavily responsible for paying for and operating portions of an extremely large project as compared to some of the other 50 conservancy districts. And then some of them have no project at all. There's conservancy districts within northeastern Colorado that envisioned a project, and for various reasons, a project didn't come to fruition. They continue to exist, but they provide other benefits to their constituents that are less about providing wet water to the region and more kind of water resource assistance.
So Brad, we got a question here. Does urban agriculture have to have their own water rights, or do they use the city's water rights? Is there a size or volume limit where they're required to purchase separate water rights? Do you know?
Boy, that's a good question with probably 100 of different answers. There are, let's just say CSA, small agricultural truck farms. I'm trying to think of the right terms. Growing produce in the cities that would rely, some of them would rely on a water tap, just like if it was an industry, that could get kind of expensive. Some of them tend to be situated near canals that run through the city, and they might own traditional agricultural water rights. In fact, they might own water rights that were on that chunk of land before there was urbanization around that land. And so in that case, they're using the same water right, which could be a fairly senior water right, just like that farm has seen for, 150 years, if it was a Some of the earlier water rights, say in the Fort Collins area, might be an 1860 water right, 1870, 1850. They could be relying on that very senior native supply. So it's a combination of a lot of different things.
Thank you. And Julie, I don't quite understand your question. Do you want to go ahead and just ask it?
Oh, I just didn't know if Brad was referring to community supported ag when he said CSA.
I sure was. Becoming more of a contemporary kind of reference to agriculture within an urbanized area. So yeah, I was talking about community supported agriculture.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Are there any other questions out there for Brad? Well, we're going to let you off easy, it looks like, Brad. For the students, I want to let you know that Brad's agreed to give me his, well, I have, to give you his work phone and his email if you'd like to talk to him. Or I highly recommend you just stop by Berthoud and go see the gardens there, because that's a nice, it's very well done.
Brad, if you have one more minute, we got a private question. It's from Samuel. He said, is there any talk about reusing water?
I think we have to be talking about that. As I hinted before, there's terms of projects of significant size, traditional projects. There's, we're advancing two of those in the region. We are optimistic we'll get those projects built. There's not a lot of water left now. Some folks say, "Hooray! That means no more people." Let me just suggest that that's probably not the case. Agriculture in our state uses about 85% of the water, and as time goes on, I think we deserve a pretty thoughtful conversation across our entire state, east and west, north and south, about, do we, and if so, at what rate do we want to start transferring, which to some degree is already happening, but absent future projects will happen at a much faster rate if we don't come to grips with what we want our future to look like, and that'll be the transferring of water from agriculture to municipal and industrial uses. Some of that happens naturally as cities grow onto irrigated lands. That water often is transferred to cities. However, I'm talking about kind of the wholesale extraction of water from parts of our state that are now providing food and fiber for our current generation. And I think we need to think about what we want to leave to future generations and our capacity to grow food in the West. That's lingering out there. I've got a few slides. If you take a look at the slide deck on your own time, there's some looming challenges out there, and I would suggest that's one of them, but it relates to reuse, and then we've got to do everything we can to be creative about reusing water, managing the water quality implications of that reuse. And I think we can find a way to do that, but we need to be thoughtful about how that's done. CBT has some unique limitations on how you can reuse it, and I won't dare go down that road right now because it gets very complicated very fast, and Jennifer's laughing. We just have some unique constraints in that water in terms of reuse, but that's not to suggest we as a regional community shouldn't start finding creative ways to make sure we get every mile out of water we can without causing impacts to other water rights on the stream, and our water law does that. It protects folks who have relied on those return flows in almost every instance as water transitions to a different kind of a use or more intensive use or reuse. Back to just one more comment on agriculture. I mentioned that I have my biases, and I will demonstrate that here. As we think about whether we want to buy and dry all of Colorado, I'm sure that term has been heard, and Jennifer shared that with you. And I get some folks, some of my urban friends who aren't as familiar with all of the Colorado Ag offers. It's about a $142 billion economy in our state. It's kind of a big deal. It's not California. It's not Nebraska. It's not Kansas, but it's a pretty big deal in our economy. It's about 10% of our GDP. And people that are less familiar with agriculture as we know it today critique, why are we growing corn, Brad, in Colorado? Why do you go to your family's farm on the weekend and enjoy growing corn? And my counter argument is, if we don't find a way to grow corn successfully now, someday that cornfield will not be corn, but I hope it'll be cucumbers. I hope it'll be carrots. I hope it'll be cabbage. I hope it'll be onions. It'll be a lot of other things in the future. But if we don't find a way to preserve that use right now, while we create this markets in Colorado, we create markets in the West for more intensive agriculture to grow some things other than corn. And people's argument is, let Iowa grow corn. They're good at it. We're good at growing cattle. So that's why the corn's here, is because there's not really a better environment to grow livestock than Colorado. But someday our food choices might change. And my argument is, let's preserve our ability to grow something. And as a society, if we think demand is shifting toward more vegetables, by all means, let's do it. But if we let the water go, it'll never, from the soil, from the hinterlands of Colorado, it will never come back to rural Colorado. It's going to be gone forever. So I just say that, asking folks to think about, let's find a way to preserve that water and agriculture, at least a lot of it, so future generations can make that decision on what they want to grow. And if they want to remove that farm and provide water to the environment, that would be another go-to, but let the future generation determine that.
Brad, this has been a fascinating hour. I want to thank you for your time on this. To the class and those watching, just a reminder that the slides and a recording of this can be found on the website, on the Colorado Water Center website, or for the class, it's on Canvas. It will be on Canvas in a couple of days. So you'll have a chance to look at that.